2012, January 31st. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 19, The First Living Things on Earth. We've been concerned this week with the history of life on Earth. And yesterday we looked at some of the current ideas about how life got started from non-life. That's kind of a tough set of ideas because we really only beginning to have a coherent story about how life got started. But once it did get started, and it looks like it got started really fast, as we'll see today, things took off pretty quickly and began to move along. And today what I want to look at now are what are the first living things to have appeared on Earth? What are the first recognizable living fossils that we find in the geological record? And in fact, some of the names for our geological eons haven't, in some sense, been misnamed, as we're going to see. And life, in fact, got started a lot earlier than people had been suspecting for a long time. In fact, it looks like as soon as the planet settled down, life got going within at least a few tens or perhaps hundreds of millions of years. So what this lecture is going to concern itself with is searches through the geological record for the very first living things on the planet. How do you do this? How do you pull this off? What we're going to see is that the oldest living things we find are not single organisms, but the remnants of mats, basically large colonies of cyanobacteria called fossil stromatolites. These are among the oldest living fossils that we've managed to find. A little bit later, when we deal with rock that's been through a little bit less processing than the oldest rocks on the Earth, we start beginning to find signs of fossil single-celled organisms called microfossils. These are the oldest known prokaryotic forms of life, and later on we're going to see old forms of eukaryotic and early multicellular life have actually been preserved in the fossil record. These things actually have managed to survive and get crystallized. Finally, we're going to look at how we can find the earliest forms of life, and we're not actually going to be able to find actual fossils, but we're going to find the evidence of chemical metabolism having been going on and leaving its traces behind. In particular, there's a particular little trick we use, although really not trick, I should really call it a technique, which uses carbon isotope ratios that are altered by biological metabolic processes. That if we find the residues of the ground up what was left of life with unusual carbon isotope ratios, that may be a signpost to the places where we see the oldest forms of life on Earth, the oldest carbon metabolism. Even if we are so old and so beaten up, you don't leave an actual fossil behind, because there are certain non-naturally occurring isotope ratios that are a sign of chemical processing of the types of things we find in living systems. So that's our concern today is, how far back can we push the geological record? How far back do we go where we find life on Earth? How fast or slow was life able to get started on our planet once the planet settled down at the end of the Hadean Aeon? So just to remind you, the oldest things, the basic fact we're going to come out of today, is that the oldest things on Earth arose sometime during the early portions of the Archean Aeon. It used to be thought, in fact, the name of the third aeon, the Proterozoic, the first life aeon, was in fact probably missing the boat by about a billion years. That's a conclusion we've come to only in the last couple of decades. To remind you, the formation of the Earth was 4.5 billion years ago, coagulating out of the solar nebula. It was a massive impact that formed the moon. Shortly after that, the moon and the Earth began to settle down, but they were continually bombarded by rocks, asteroids, and comets, which are the raw materials out of which the planets in the solar system were built. This is this epoch of heavy bombardment. This continues along until you get to the what's called late heavy bombardment, where there's a rapid, very dramatic, exponential tail off as the last of the rocky material that built the solar system begins to clear away. And this occurs about 3.8 billion years ago. The impacts were frequent, deadly, able to basically completely sterilize the planet. Even if the Earth had been able to form oceans relatively early during the Hadean Aeon, and we have a couple of evidences of that, nonetheless, an impact with an asteroid of between 300 and 500 kilometers, so a big guy, hitting the Earth is capable of boiling off the oceans, turning the surface into magma. You basically have immense magma seas, maybe not a completely molten planet, but at least certain large sections of it are molten rock. The atmosphere is filled with heavy steam. Any life that we understand, even the most hardcore extremophiles, would not survive. And so we refer to these as sterilizing bombardments. But those big rocks are rare, and as the material of the solar system gets cleared away, they become rarer still, and eventually you reach the end of the late heavy bombardment where you have the last sterilizing impact. The Earth settles down pretty quickly. We can find evidence of zircons being formed in the presence of liquid water, suggesting the oceans formed very rapidly at the end of the Hadean Eon. At the end of the Hadean, we go to what's called the Archaean, the ancient eon, which is lasting between 2.5 and 3.8 billion years ago. It ends with heavy bombardment and was thought to be a period when the Earth was basically consolidating its biosphere. But as we've actually learned, the first versions of life actually began to appear. And in this particular drawing, it has Earth life beginning around 3.5 billion years ago in the way this is the sketch from your book. The challenge of finding the Earth's oldest fossils is simply the same problem we have finding the oldest Earth rocks writ large, namely that the Earth is geologically active. And we're missing a little core there. Don't know why that happened. What happens here is the Earth's crust is constantly being turned over. So the average age of the crust is about 100 million years, which means most of the surface rocks have either been subducted as two plates collide together and one mashes below the other and the rock gets remelted. Or they're regions which have been recently repaved by volcanic activity, either in the places where the crustal plates are pulling apart, along rift valleys or deep ocean ridges, or places where there are hotspot volcanism which repaves the surface. Either way, the average age of rock on the Earth is relatively young, geologically speaking. But there are going to be locations in the middles of the largest continental plates, the thickest, heaviest parts of the crust, that have managed to be far enough away from volcanism to survive from the earliest times. And the current record holders are a series of areas in the continental plate of Australia, down in the middle of the Australian continent, in particular the Jack Hills region and the Australian outback. We found 4.4 billion-year-old zircons within that rock. Up in Canada, actually up towards some of the colder portions of Canada in the Canadian Shield, is what we often refer to as the acoustic gneiss formation. This has been dated out to about a little over 4 billion years old. In Greenland, on the island of Greenland, there's a region of greenstone near a place called Iswa, which has been revealed only recently because of retreating ice, and is shown to have some formations, again, usually uranium-lead isotope dating in zircons of about 3.8 billion years old. So it's very challenging, but we can find the oldest rocks on Earth, and we can push it back to about 4.4 billion years, and probably the oldest surviving major piece of our crust in Australia. The problem of finding fossils, survivals of living things, which tend to be relatively soft, is even more challenging than finding these ancient rocks. We have to have a situation in which the soft tissues were invaded by silicates and other things and basically crystallized into a rock formation. What the fossil is not the soft parts remaining, but basically kind of a shell that's been crystallized by taking up things like calcium and silicates from the environment and forming it basically into a rock. And these rocks are rather odd looking. They're rather nondescript looking. You have to know what to look for. This is an example of some nearly 4.25 billion-year-old rock up from the Canadian Shield. To give you a feeling for how very difficult it is to find not only very old fossils going back into the beginning of the Archean, but even further back, is this very nice map of the United States showing exposures of rock that are older than the Precambrian, the Cambrian epoch, which is the start of the Phanerozoic 600 million years ago in round numbers. So everything you see in gray here is rock that is younger than 600 million years old. And the range we have is between the lower Archean, the start of the Archean eon about 3.8 billion years ago, up to what's called the upper Proterozoic, which marks the end of the Proterozoic eon and the beginning of the Phanerozoic and the Cambrian. And what you can see is the oldest rocks are really concentrated up towards Canada. For example, in northern Minnesota, northern Michigan, we see some of the oldest of the Archean rocks. There are some Archean exposures in the front range of the Rocky Mountains and in the southern ranges, the Sonora ranges down in Arizona. Other than that, when you get up into places like Montana, Idaho, you're starting to get into the transition between the Archaean and Proterozoic. And even to get upper Proterozoic, you have to basically get into exposures which are like in the Appalachians, which are up in Vermont and New Hampshire. So it's very rare to find really good surface exposures, except in very, very remote places, usually where that rock has been folded up into the current crust. In this case, for example, the Appalachians and the Rockies are caused by compression of the Earth's crust and folding upward of older material out that was deep underground up into the surface. There are smaller exposures. There are places, for example, in Pennsylvania and others which go back into the Cambrian and beyond, but there's no Proterozoic, there's no Archean rocks in the state of Ohio or Pennsylvania, except for the few places where they cross over here in the Appalachians. So it's really challenging. There's a very small number of places just in our own country. You can show similar maps for around the world. But there are places with really, really ancient rock. This is a picture of the Canadian Archean Shield. This is well north of us. In fact, it's up north of Ontario, up really up into the cold, really nasty parts of Canada, the real great white, the honest to goodness great white north. I like this picture because in many ways this picture is showing you the bones of the Earth. This is some of the oldest rock on our planet is up in the shield. This is the remnants of the Archean period. And this is the piece we have to sift, both here in Australia, in a couple sections in South America and Greenland, that still have an exposure of the Archean rock, of the oldest surviving rock from an epoch, an eon, which lasted more than a billion years. And it's during this eon that we're going to be looking for the oldest forms of life. So what are we going to go look for? Well, we're not going to be looking for bones. We're not going to be looking for advanced skeletal remains. We're not going to be looking for higher animals. We're really going to be looking for evidence of microscopic life. And that's pretty challenging. It's hard enough to find microscopic life all by itself when it's living. How does microscopic life become a fossil? One of the ways we can do that is we can look at some of the microscopic forms of life that exist today that had as their distant ancestors these first forms of microscopic life, and it gives us clues for what to look for. And in particular, one particular group of organisms catches our attention. They're called stromatolites. Stromatolites are basically layered rocks that are formed by large mats, usually of cyanobacteria trapped by these microbes. Now, cyanobacteria are methane-eating bacteria in the old days. They're still extant today. They tend to be considered extremophiles. But you can also form stromatolites from non-cyanogenic bacteria. Basically, they live in very, very shallow marine lagoons, and they live in hypersaline lakes. So, for example, a lot of stromatolites are based on cyanobacteria that are also salt lovers. They're halophiles. So, for example, this photograph here from Lake Thetis in Western Australia is extremely salty, hypersaline water. And you see these mounds here. This is actually leftover rock and precipitate that's trapped behind as these mats of microbes begin to grow. What happens is you actually get a trapping of sediments, mostly sand and other things, because these mats of these cyanobacteria excrete a mucus. That mucus traps the rock, and eventually the rock builds up so much that the bacteria have to move on top of the layer to get access to sunlight. They're photosynthetic. At least the current day versions are photosynthetic. So they crawl up on top of the layers. They begin to excrete the mucus, which is part of their colony. But of course, whenever you have sticky mucus around and the wind blows, you get sand, you get salt piles up, and they get kind of buried. The ones in the bottom below, the ones that survive, can work their way to the top. And you build up layer after layer of rock held together by kind of a mucus glue. And that's what you get, is this mucus-like secretion from these things builds up these steady mats as the life basically keeps crawling up towards the light and leaving behind a residue of all the junk that sticks to its mucus secretions. Kind of nasty-looking things. If you ever see these things live, they're really, they're nasty. It's just really like sort of, microbiological snot is the best description of living stromatolite mats. They're really kind of gross. But they leave behind these very distinctive layered formations. Those distinctive layered formations survive as large enough to basically form fossils because they're actual little geological formations, but they're geological formations built by living organisms. And they leave behind the dead organisms locked inside those sedimentary layers. So we, in fact, see this. We see fossil stromatolites that become very abundant during the Archean eon. The biggest sort of the epoch, if you will, of stromatolites is about 2.8 billion years ago, kind of right smack in the middle to upper portion of the Archean eon. And these fossils are very, very distinctive. You get these sort of wavy, lines, these sort of layering of stuff that you see is the cross sections as you cut into these various layerings of life. And what you find in between the layers are the fossil microbes. You find the evidence of metabolic chemistry if the stuff has been super compressed, and you actually find microfossils of some of the bacteria, the cyanobacteria that left them to be behind. So for example, here are some wonderful examples up from the state of Michigan. There's a very small exposure of Archean material up in Upper Michigan, as we saw on that map. And in fact, one of the dominant fossil forms from that period are these 2.8 billion year old stromatolite beds. The dates are usually set by finding zircons within those same layers using uranium lead isotope radio dating. So this is a very promising form of life to look for. It leaves behind a kind of a quasi-geological formation. Even though the creatures themselves are microscopic, they lived in these macroscopic colonies and built these kind of mounds through this process of sedimentation buildup. So they're very, very striking, and it gives you something to look at in otherwise what looks like undistinguishable rock. And these layering formations, especially when you dig into them, you find the carbon and other things. The question is, how far back have we been able to push it? 2.8 billion years, kind of mid-Archean, was kind of thought to be about as old as it went. But as people in recent years have begun to push backwards, they found earlier and even earlier stromatolites. Now, one of the problems, of course, is the older you go in the rock, the more geological processing it's going to be subjected to. But people have actually pushed it back to about now about 3.5 billion years. They found stromatolites. Here's a particular stromatolite. It's from the Strelley Pool Stromatolite Foundation out in Western Australia. It was recently studied by Abigail Allwood, a postdoc, and her colleagues at Caltech, my old alma mater, and were able to find that even though this stuff has been very heavily processed, it does in fact show some remnants of the microbiological creatures that made it. The problem with older rock is, remember, that rock tends to get heated and compressed. That heating and compression tends to destroy both the microbes, and it destroys and breaks down the organic compounds. So what you've got to do is you leave behind carbon, but you get a layered shape remain. So that the basic shape remains, but you destroy the stuff between the layers that was once living. And so you basically grind it up, and it's just pretty much gone. But there's a few of these very old ones, and Strelley Pool in particular, where you can see the microbiological origin still remaining. It hasn't been as subject to as heavy processing as some of the older stromatolite-like formations. So a lot of older stromatolite-like layerings had been found, but they've been so heavily processed, so heated, they destroyed all the organics. It's only recently that the Strelley Pool Formation in Australia has actually revealed these organics. Now, I got a little something over here, just for fun. Come alive. And switch to the document camera. Just to show you that these aren't just, come alive, thank you, pictures. This is a this is from my collection of fossils. This is a Strelley Pool stromatolite stripe. It's taken through here. Now, some of this overstaining is part of polishing this, but you can see the layered effects here. This is from a region of Strelley Pool which has been dated by zircon uranium lead isotope dating to 3.4 billion years old. So this is part of the things that are really cool about this stuff, is that this is part of the formation that has been confirmed to be of microbiological origin. So if you're invited to come up after class and look at that, that little funny looking layered piece of rock was living 3.5 billion years ago. This is how old life has actually managed to become on Earth. You get these beautiful layered formations. You can actually see what one of these things look like. So they're really pretty cool. Turn that off there. And back to the screen. Yeah. So it's really been Australia, that older Australian shield, has managed to have some relatively unprocessed rock that's really helped us out. The problem is that we're dealing with fairly macroscopic formations. So single microbes, it's very difficult for them to survive. But you have so many of them in these huge microscopic mats that you have at least have a fighting chance. And you can leave behind both the chemical residues and everything else. But the question is, can you actually begin to see actual fossils of single-celled or multicellular life, so-called microfossils? And the answer to that is yes, we in fact do begin to see these in the geological record, but they're even more challenging because they're even more subject to destruction by heat and pressure as rocks are processed. But a few have managed to survive. They've mainly managed to survive in a series of chert formations or particular geological formations that have been kind of left alone. And what's useful about these things is the way in which they fossilized leaves intact the outline of the basic cellular structure. You can see the cell shape. This is, in fact, a little strand of a cyanobacterium, which usually form themselves in long strands made up of nearby, you know, copies of themselves. But you can still see the surviving cell structure, the outer membrane, the whatever the inner bits were. Now, of course, the inner bits have all been turned into crystals of something, usually calcium formations. Chert formations are very rich in calcium, which is one of the agents which when leaching inside of the cells, forms them into rock-like formations. So we don't have any DNA survivals or RNA survivals, but we do see the same basic structures. And when some of these things, which are extremely rare, so you only very carefully break down a handful of these, we find that they do contain still the remnants of very complex organic compounds, the kinds of amino acid compounds, proteins, broken up things that have managed to survive even the process of fossilization. As we go into some of these formations, and again, younger rock, you have much more chance of survival. There's been less pressure and heat processing in the rock. We can actually see some quite remarkable microfossils in these. These are examples of, these are very small. You can see the sizes here. These are 5, 10, 15, 20 microns across. So they're all microscopic. These are found from something called the Gunflint Chert up near Lake Superior in Canada. This is a formation that's been dated to be between about 1.9 and 2.3 billion years ago. It was laid down over a very long period of time, about 400 million years. And we find inside of there, these are old prokaryotic forms of life, single cells, which we can see very complex, both chains of these things, and single groups. There's a close-up of one of the cyanobacteria we showed in the previous picture. Round spherical shapes with membranes. We can see them caught and fossilized. They were killed basically in the process of division. We can see all of the stages of life we see in modern prokaryotes preserved and frozen in these high calcium chert formations that have managed to fossilize these single microbes. These are the rarest fossils on the planet. What's interesting is as we look at some of the really, really well-preserved ones, like this microfossil, the one I just showed you the picture of before two back, which is from the Bitter Springs Chert Formation, is some of these very strongly resemble modern cyanobacteria. That's how we could make the association that these were probably methane-eating, you know, blue-green algae is what we often refer to them today. They're not really algae, they're actually bacteria. So on the right-hand side is a modern cyanobacterium. It's got the characteristic green shape. These are photosynthetic. They eat methane instead of carbon dioxide, but they're still photosynthetic. They show a nice green shape to them, and they show this multicellular string structure. These are not multicelled creatures. These are not differentiated into different functions. They simply hang on to each other as cells. When the cells divide, you simply make the chain get bigger and bigger. And we see the same sort of structure here in this Bitter Springs Chert formation. This one here in particular is about 2 billion years old. So even when we get sort of to the late Archean, early Proterozoic, by the time we're into the Proterozoic eon, we have readily identifiable microfossils. We can see all of the cellular structures, even in somewhat primitive survival forms. We can see forms that very strongly resemble what's going on inside some of the modern-day equivalents of these same organisms. The problem, of course, is that some of these microfossils get to be very contentious because they have been subject to processing. Not everything that looks like a fossil, microscopic fossil, is a microscopic fossil. You can't just simply go on appearances alone. You have to do a full-scale chemical analysis. You want to look for the complex organics and other structures that are only found inside a biologically processed material. There are lots of things that can fool you. You may remember, and it's still running around, there was a really big press release quite a long time ago now. This is going back into the Clinton administration, so about 10, 12 years ago, of the possibility of finding not microfossils but nanofossils in a rock that was knocked off the planet Mars. And it was thought to be possible evidence of ancient life on the planet Mars. Those are examples of bacteria-like structures found in the Mars rock, and we'll talk about this later in the class, which look like biological systems but do not show any evidence of complex organic chemistry. And that's why people don't buy it as a real example of Mars life. But you can see how you can get fooled by shape. So it's not just shape. We have to look at the basic structures. Here's some more examples of these things showing from the Apex Chert. These are claimed to be as old as 3.5 billion years old. These are these long string structures. This is an example of these highly controversial microfossils. These are very old. They've been subject to a huge amount of processing. And right now, the data are controversial as to whether these show the kinds of complex organics or not that you would expect of the much younger, meaning 2 billion year old and younger, microfossils for which it's pretty securely known. And part of the reason is these things are really beat up and crushed. The long strings here are kind of suspicious. We don't really see things that look quite like this. And the other thing is the type of biological analysis, you have to be very careful how you do it, that you don't contaminate it in your laboratory. And so part of the counterpoint that's been going on about the Dresser and Apex Chert formation microfossil candidates is whether or not proper controls have been kept in trying to keep out the kind of contamination that can lead you to seeing organics, which in fact are because you just don't have good experimental controls. So this is an example of candidate microfossils which are still highly contentious because they don't have this smoking gun appearance of complex organics and they don't have clear cellular structure. They're just too beat up. And they're too beat up by their ancient date. Now, one of the ways, let's look at some of the ways in which we can take these microfossils and try to understand what's going on in them. Maybe we can, in fact, show signs of life even if the fossil bodies themselves have not survived all the geological processing. We can do this by looking at one of the techniques of analysis that's used on the really bona fide microfossils, and that's namely carbon isotope analysis. Carbon isotopes, carbon comes in many different forms. It has two stable isotopes, the regular carbon-12, 6 protons, 6 neutrons, that's the most common form of carbon, to carbon-13, which is a heavy carbon, has one extra neutron. 6 protons has its carbon, but 7 neutrons instead of 6. So we call it carbon-13. This heavy carbon is relatively underabundant. The ratio of 13 carbon to 12 carbon in nature, you know, as it's made in stars and other places where carbon is belched out, is about 1 part in 90. So if I took a big lump of coal, broke it down, and said, what is the typical fraction of carbon-13 to carbon-12? It's about 1 atom for every 90 carbon-12 atoms will be carbon-13. Now, the difference here is that that's what the naturally occurring abundance is. We see it on Earth in non-biological carbon formations. We see it in interstellar space. If I go out and I can find interstellar molecules of carbon monoxide, measure the 13 to 12 CO ratio, you get this cosmic ratio, we call it, of 1 out of 90. So it's pretty well defined how nature makes the carbon as the original nucleosynthesis that goes on in stars. However, if cell metabolism gets its hands on carbon, it turns out that the chemical reactions are much more likely to occur with carbon-12 than with carbon-13. There's an effect known as carbon fractionation in some of the organic chemistry. What happens is, if you're sitting there scrubbing up carbon from the environment, it may be carbon dioxide in the air, it could be carbon dioxide dissolved into water, or you could be a heterotroph and you're eating organic material because you're, you know, a plant or something that's, you know, an animal is eating some carbon-based material. The organic chemistry in the cells that takes up that carbon prefers to take up light carbon, carbon-12, and tends to leave the carbon-13 behind. So what happens is, if you have a cells bringing up carbon, you tend to enhance the carbon-12 to carbon-13 ratio. So much so that you say that the carbon-13 becomes depleted. It just simply isn't taken up biologically, and it's left behind. A little bit is taken up. It's not 100%, but it's enough that you begin to skew the ratio. So instead of being carbon-13 to carbon-12 being 1 out of 90, it becomes 1 out of 100, 1 out of 300, 1 out of 400. It can actually be quite substantial depletions depending upon the biological process. Now, this is not a 100% ironclad way to do it. There turn out to be a number of abiotic ways to alter the carbon-13 to carbon-12 ratio. This isotope fractionation, as it's called, that occurs in biological chemistry can also occur in some non-biological chemistry. For example, the rate at which carbon is taken up when it's dissolved in ocean water. There's a slightly different rate of take-up for carbon-12 versus carbon-13. So you have to be somewhat careful about how you interpret the results. So, but still, nonetheless, this gives you a handle. The oldest claim, and still being worked on, this is only a couple years old, for finding biogenic carbon-13 depletion, differential take-up of carbon-12 over carbon-13, goes back to a formation known as the Achillea Island Formation in western Greenland. The dating on this particular region from, again, uranium, lead, isotope dating of zircons is 3.85 billion years old. That's a really remarkable claim for two reasons. One is 3.85 billion years old puts this rock right smack in the middle of the last epoch of heavy bombardment. It puts it into the Hadean, outside. It goes beyond the boundary of the early Archean. And finally, it's found in igneous rock nearby to this banded formation of sedimentary rock. But it doesn't show the kinds of coherent structures we find, for example, in the oldest stromatolites. So it's basically saying we've got this banded sedimentary rock that's been built up layer on layer. There are carbon-rich layers within that sedimentary rock, and some of those carbon-13 layers show 13 carbon to 12 carbon depletion patterns, which are consistent with biological carbon-13 isotope depletion as seen in modern creatures and to some degree as seen in fossil stromatolites, which show this carbon-13, carbon-12 depletion pattern. The problem is this just is not what you expect. This rock has been very heavily processed. Whatever microfossils were in it have been thoroughly destroyed over the last 3.8 billion years of geology. And so this Achillea Island banded formation result has shown up. It pops up in the news every now and then as the oldest form of life. It's very controversial at present because there are abiotic ways to explain the carbon isotope ratio. So the kind of bottom line I'm trying to reach on this is we can use these carbon isotope ratios. We've used them very successfully where we see that the fossils really are very well preserved. We can see it. It's used, for example, to test whether a stromatolite foundation really was biological or just some chance layering of sedimentary rock. And it works pretty well where you have other pieces of evidence to back up the biological carbon-13 depletion interpretation. But when we try to push further and further back in geologic time, we're running into greater and greater rock processing. And people are now using these techniques, but they're kind of hanging it out because instead of having a body of evidence itself consistently hangs together, they're looking for single handholds on this rather steep cliff. And so it's going to be very difficult. Which, you know, the importance of studies like this, even if you don't believe the exact result, is this might be a way that you find a candidate area for further study. But you've got to find it in these highly isolated, extremely rare formations that have managed to survive, you know, 3-4 billion years of the geological processing of our planet. So that gives you just a piece of just how challenging finding these ancient fossils is. Well, let's just take a look at what the first forms of life were like. We've been paying attention mostly to these microfossils. We've been paying attention to these stromatolites. What were their life cycles like? What kind of creatures were they? We only see sort of the leftovers of them. We don't really understand what their life cycles are. But we have a hint as to what they're like. They may, in fact, have been extremophiles. The survivals to the present day of these very early forms of life live as these very extreme forms of life we saw last Friday. These microbes, mostly archaea and a few bacteria and a tiny handful of eukaryotes that have become superbly well adapted to living in extreme environments, extremes of heat, extremes of cold, extremes of salinity, extremes of acidity. But very likely, if we look through this, I showed this picture on Friday and I'll show it again, is it looks like if we look in the genetic evidence, you look at the distance from the branches between the bacteria, the archaea, and the eukarya in this phylogenetic tree of life, the further you get from the central branches, the greater amount of time has elapsed and the greater you are in genetic difference from surrounding creatures. The colors that are coded here are coded by growth temperatures in the current day creatures. So red are things that can survive growing even at temperatures up to 90 degrees Celsius, 10 degrees C below boiling water. Yellow is between 60 and 90 degrees Celsius, and green is 60 degrees Celsius and below. Hot, but not sterilizing hot. 100 degrees Celsius is pretty much where things get sterilized, unless they're very, very extreme, and there's only a handful of things that survive actual boiling at regular room pressures. You can actually get to higher temperatures, but you're under the extreme pressures of the deep seabed. So it's not quite the same as boiling water on the surface, because as you put things under pressure, you raise the boiling temperature. And so this shows basically that if you look at the archaea, heat-tolerant archaea extend very far up the phylogenetic tree for these ancient types of bacteria. Whereas bacteria, it only goes up a few branches before you only get modest heat resistance. And then in the eukarya, it runs out of heat resistance almost immediately. And that gets up. Remember, eukarya, we're way out here on this tail. So these things are mostly plants, fungi, things like that. A lot of single-celled organisms down in here. Amoebas are down in here. Some, I forget where. I can't read the list there. So what we see is, as we go back further towards where the branches of bacteria, archaea, and eukarya come together, we're getting to the genetically oldest life forms of life on Earth. We're getting closer and closer to the common ancestor of all three of these branches. And what we find is increasing heat tolerance. And that's taken as evidence by comparison with modern-day creatures that prokaryotes tend to be more heat tolerant, and that because we have deep hydrothermal vents deep in the ocean, which would be protected from some of the nastier bits of the Earth's environment by being deep in the ocean, provides heat, provides ready access to dissolved inorganics. These creatures are very likely going to be thermophiles. They're going to be adapted to extremes of heat, and they're probably going to be chemosynthetic, meaning that they get their energy source by inorganic oxidation. So they are, for the most part, probably chemoautotrophs. They get their carbon dioxide from dissolved seawater, and they get their energy source from inorganic oxidation. However, there's a different school of thought that suggests that maybe, in fact, the first forms of life were photosynthetic, meaning they get their photoautotrophs. Autotrophs tells you they get their carbon dioxide again from dissolved in seawater, but they use sunlight, and they're much more near the surface. The arguments for photosynthesis is the cyanobacteria microfossils and the stromatolites. These are examples of creatures that use sunlight, that use carbon dioxide or carbon in the form of methane, the methanogens, that can actually take up that carbon and then use a sunlight photosynthetic process to make their, to provide the energy to power their metabolism. Almost all the microfossils that we have are photosynthetic, except for a handful. We know they're photosynthetic because of modern analogs and where they're found. Whereas a number could be chemosynthetic, but it's really hard to tell from what's left. So we don't actually know for sure. The suspicion is that chemoautotrophs came first, but bear in mind that the fossil evidence, the ones that survived, are from relatively shallow marine layers, and they appear to be analogs of modern photosynthetics. So we haven't really closed this argument yet. The bottom line here is this. Okay, we've seen a series of evidences. It's pretty clear that stromatolites very well established as biological systems as far back as 2.5 billion years in the middle of the Proterozoic eon. But in fact, we've been able to show recently that we can find stromatolites which are identifiably biologically processing systems as far back as nearly 3.5 billion years, whether it's 3.3, 3.4 in the case of Strelley Pool, or perhaps even as extreme as 3.6, if the Achillea Island formation really is pointing to the possibility of biological carbon processing as early as the late Hadean eon. That would be extremely surprising, but it's very important. And the reason why it's important is if you look, just take the date that we think is pretty secure, and that's the Strelley Pool formation, the one that's represented by this fossil over here. That time, 3.4 billion years ago, is only 100 million years after the end of the late heavy bombardment. That means that the Earth, we know from seeing zircons, which were made in the presence of liquid water, that the Earth had oceans, certainly during the late Hadean and definitely the early Archean eons. We don't know what these first organisms were like, but the first stromatolites have survived to 100 million years, just 100 million years after the end of late heavy bombardment. That means that life, when it got going really fast. It was a much shorter interval. It was a long time that people thought it took a very long time for whatever the chemistry processes were that led from non-life to life, the abiogenesis, was going to take time. It was going to be slow and was going to take a billion years. But now the evidence is showing it's whatever it is, it's fast. It's real fast. So fast, in fact, life may have in fact emerged first on Earth even during the Hadean eon, but all forms of that life were completely erased by the sterilizing impacts that were bombarding the Earth constantly until 3.5 billion years ago. We don't know what form that life takes. We don't know if it was photosynthetic or chemosynthesis came first. The balance of argument now is aiming towards chemosynthesis, as I mentioned, but we do see evidence of very early photosynthesis, again, within a few hundred million years of the first fossil forms. We know, again, we see these trimetallite formations, that life got a hold really early. And once life started, and once you started having natural selection act upon it, biodiversity followed pretty quickly. Although, as we're going to see tomorrow, we now want to pick up these fairly humble beginnings of algae mats and others and carry it forward through the fossil record, through the geological record, and look at the detailed history of life from the first emergence at the beginning of the Archean eon up to today. And that's where we're going to go with this tomorrow. Any questions? Okay. See you all tomorrow then.